as much as I say, get started, make sure that you're not doing it just to do it. I've done that where I've just wanted to buy units that month. And then those were the worst units that I bought. I didn't do enough due diligence, or I didn't get a good enough financial terms. I should have waited longer. I would say, make sure you do your due diligence and then go and buy the property and then cash flow from it. And then just rinse and repeat that as many times as you want.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Tom Cruise is a 33-year-old real estate investor out of Wilmington, North Carolina. And after graduating from UNCW, Tom started wholesaling real estate, graduated to buying single and small multifamily properties, and he got his start with the Section 8 program on accident by purchasing a unit with a tenant that was Section 8. Since that time, Tom has bought and sold over 500 units and currently solely owns 390-plus properties. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. I mean, that's a lot of activity. I want to get all the way to the end of how you wound up owning 390 properties on your own. That's an impressive metric that I think many aspire to. There's three questions, however, that I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you very, very quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now and how you got there?
Sure. I started with condos and single family properties. I eventually graduated to small multifamily and then just kind of continued scaling into Section 8. I got there through the use of other people's monies, partnerships, equity deals, and building a lot of strong relationships with local community banks and lenders. And currently, I have 400 units. I have another 100 units pending in Jacksonville, North Carolina, single family portfolio that I found off market. And that was kind of the, in a nutshell, where I'm at.
Man, that's great. I love that. Now that you win the award for almost the quickest round. You know, I asked for that section quickly because I figured out in the first, 100 episodes of this show that that section could take like 20 minutes of the show. And I'm like, okay, we're going to really get this one short. So you win.
Yeah.
That was pretty truncated. Hopefully you gave us enough here to dig into on your story.
Oh yeah. I mean, it can go a lot more.
Absolutely. You started in condos. You started using other people's money. Walk us through a little bit of this process, the iterations of your business and why you continued to have iterations of it. And then all the way down to buying 100 unit or 100 homes packages.
Yeah. I started with condos. I bought my first primary residence. It was a condo, lived in it for a little over a year. I got an FHA loan, usual 3% down. Shout out to Obama. I got $8,000 tax credit from Obama. Got into that from that. And then after a year, I bought a big dog, Doberman Pinscher, and wasn't able to have him in my condo. So that was kind of the catalyst to buying another single family house. And I couldn't sell the condo. I was in pretty rough equity shape in that first unit. Even with Obama tax money, it wasn't enough to get me in a good equity position. So I rented it. Rented it to a very nice lesbian couple off Craigslist on day one. And I was making $500 over my mortgage there. It was a no-brainer. I had a marketing kind of side hustle at the time, and I was making $500 a month slaving away for a client every month, or I was making $500 a month doing nothing for a very nice couple that was taking care of my unit. So here we are. That was kind of the light bulb moment where I realized that I needed to start buying more units.
Right. There's nothing like that wake up. You're like, wow, I'm working really hard for this and I'm not working really hard for this and they're paying me the same.
Yeah, exactly.
What'd you do next? What was your next step?
Yeah. So next step was buying more units. So at that point, I had my $500 coming in from there. I knew that I needed to be able to kind of accelerate my cash flow to be able to buy more units. So I got into wholesaling properties. Your listeners don't know. It's essentially putting a property under contract, finding somebody that would want to take over that contract and flipping it. You're essentially selling the paper. And I did that with single family units in Wilmington. And I was making between $5,000 and $7,000 per deal. And I knew that in order to buy an $80,000 condo with 20% down in closing costs, I needed around 18 to 19 grand. So that was kind of my goal every month, was to raise that through wholesaling, the reinvesting my cash flow from my one unit, combine that with the income from my marketing hustle. And that's kind of how I was able to start the snowball effect.
Awesome. And you've stayed primarily in the single family space, but mixing in small multifamily as well.
That's correct. Yeah, I just found a lot of luck here. There's not a lot of big multifamily, so I never really got tempted into getting into that apartment complex space. The cash flow, the appreciation, the liquidity, everything about single family I love. And I happened to be in a market that was already primed for it, so it made that easier to do it locally too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Talk to us about scaling the single family side. It's interesting. I had another guest on the show. I don't know when that guest will air, but yesterday I was interviewing them. And they've done the same thing that you have. And I got to ask them a question because typically the argument goes, that you can't scale single family in the way that you could buy 400 units of an apartment complex all at once. Like, the economies of scale aren't there. The challenges, geographic diversity, it's all over the place. Crews are all over the place. Management's a hassle. Walk us through how you figured out how to kind of get past a lot of the hurdles that are commonly thrown up in the single family space.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to process and people. I mean, I built out my own property management software. I knew that we were doing Section 8, and Section 8 requires partial payments from the tenant and the tenant and the payment from the government. So a lot of the, you know, appfolios and buildiums and all the traditional stuff really wasn't cutting it for single investors that want to scale. So I built out my own platform, kind of come up with a handbook for my property managers. I didn't use property management companies. That was another big difference, was to be able to have my own property management team in-house and hired my own property managers that I taught myself, because I managed my first 30 units by myself. So I already knew what I was doing as far as the management side. So being able to have that control makes things a whole lot easier to scale. And I was also buying in maybe 3 zip codes in a surrounding area. So having crews go into different areas for inspections is not that big of a deal in a minute radius. So from that standpoint, it was relatively straightforward. Inventory at the time was not a big deal. Now it is locally. So I've gone out to Ohio, I've gone out to Indiana and other places. But when I was scaling, there was at any given time between 100 and 200 units under $100,000 that were move-in ready in my city.
Wow. What's the rent to price ratio there in Wilmington?
Back in 2016, 17, 18, and 19, while I was really doing really aggressively, 1.5% was the norm.
Wow.
Yeah. So I mean, on a $100,000 unit, Section 8, 3 or 4 bedroom, you get between $1,300 and $1,500 a door.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's how I got into Section 8. I fell into it by accident. I bought a $55,000 unit. This can all be fact checked. 208 Gores Row, Wilmington, North Carolina. Bought a 208 Gores Row, bought it for $55,000. I put my 20% down, got it with the local credit union. The tenant at the time was $1,350 a month. And when I bought it, I didn't know they were Section 8. So the day after I closed on it, the landlord calls me and he was like, hey, you need to switch over to direct deposit to Section 8. And I freaked out. I had no idea what was going on. Like, I had never dealt with Section 8 at the time. So I was like, oh my God, I got to deal with this. And turned out it was easy. They switched over to me. They had the full portion. The landlord looked at me like I was crazy. He's like, how did you think I was getting $1,350 on a $55,000 unit? You know, so anyways, I learned real fast. I learned the inspection process. I learned how it all worked. And from that point on, I just continue acquiring.
Yeah, that's brilliant. There's no failure, only feedback. And it sounded like the feedback you got was really good, though it wasn't even really what you were expecting. Yeah, because at $1,350 a month, I mean, of course, I don't know what your mortgage was, but I mean, in 10 months,
$280 a month.
Yeah. So in 10 months, you've made your money back because you put $11,000 down.
Oh, yeah. It was an amazing ROI, probably like an 80% cash on cash return.
Right. Yeah. You find any more of those, just go ahead and call me.
Yeah, I will do. They're all over Ohio. So now that's where we're at, but it's not $1,350, $1,500 anymore.
Sure. No, I understand, man. That's awesome. So talk to us about the Section 8 program. What did you have to learn the hard way and what came really the easy way?
The hard way was the tenant screening, just being able to understand their process, what not to assume. A lot of people assume with Section 8, since the money's guaranteed, you don't have to do much screening on the tenant because you're going to get your money either way, which is completely false. That's what really where a lot of people get tripped up. And where it gets a bad rap from is people think, oh, Section 8, they're going to wreck your unit. That's not the case. It's just lazy landlords that don't actually screen tenants because they assume the money's guaranteed, the tenant's guaranteed. The tenant can still just as well turn your house into a trap house and start selling drugs out of it if screen them correctly. So that was the hardest part, was understanding on getting a streamlined process where we check evictions, credit, background. Now we do home visits. I mean, it's gotten, you know, very scientific at this point. It's an assembly line at this point.
Sure. But yet at the same time, you're telling me that just because it's Section 8, you need to do all the normal things you do with any tenant.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, the things you should be doing, I don't know many landlords that are going to take a property manager and have them go to the tenant's existing unit, but we do that. Yeah. So we go a step further.
And what have you found? I mean, it sounds like that lesson was learned the painful way.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I've had everything happen, man. I've had the 3 a.m. calls, New Hanover County SWAT team. We just breached your house. We've had a meth, you know, lab inside. We've 3 AK-47s, 2 AR-15s, and $100,000 in cash. You need to send your contractor out here to board up the properties. I've had property managers have to shoo away drug deals outside of the front of the house in order for them to show the unit to a tenant. I mean, I've had it all. When you deal with low income, it is what it is. You're going to have some interesting stories. But yeah, and I mean, that's all part of the game.
Well, sure. I guess I'm thinking there was an event that made you say, I am going now to their existing place, wherever they live now.
Oh, yeah. Well, hoarding. Hoarding is the biggest issue because it's the most expensive. Because if they leave the house in a hoarded condition, then you're going to be spending several thousands of dollars of cleaning it, getting everything back turned over. So I had multiple situations where that came into play.
That's interesting. Yeah, it is an interesting thing how the face of poverty has changed, or lower income, where the amount of stuff that that group can own is now just incredible. So yeah, I've been there one too many times myself where you have knee deep in stuff and you're like, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work.
And that just comes from experience, and there's no way we would have found out about that. Because the thing is, like, once you have enough good tenants, then you're like, oh, this is so easy. You get confident, and then it just takes that one tenant just to ruin everything for you. So
yeah, absolutely. Talk to us about, I mean, did you hold a job after you graduated from college, or was it, hey, I'm just going to go straight into real estate?
Yeah, no, I've never had a full-time W-2. Well, I did for 2 weeks at Circuit City, and then they wanted me to work Black Friday, and I didn't want to work Black Friday, so they fired me. But that was the only job. Outside of that, I've always had my own thing. Had a marketing side hustle pretty much all through college. Before then, I sold paintball guns online, and before that, I sold, like, random things, Pokemon cards, whatever, in middle school and high school.
So where did you learn your business sense on the developing of teams, implementing systems, that side of things?
A lot of trial and error. I mean, on the property management side, I went through everything. I went through finding property management companies. I went with the big guys, the Century 21s and the Remaxes. And then I went with the small guys. That was literally like two guys in an office. And it's just both a huge hassle to deal with a third party, especially at scale, anything past 50 units, because you're no longer the priority. They have 500 other units. And if a unit goes vacant and your unit's like just one of their many units, there's going to be a bunch of other people that they're going to show other units to. So with mine, I know that my property managers are only showing my units. So I can keep occupancy. I don't think we've ever had a turnover last longer than 3 weeks, or vacancy last longer than 3 weeks. We get them switched. We send it to Section 8. We get a tenant very quickly. So it makes it a whole lot easier.
Now, are you managing now for other people or just your portfolio?
No, I can't think of a greater hell than owning a property management company where you're managing third people for other people. It doesn't make any sense to me why anybody would get into that business. It's mind blowing to make $150 per month on a rental unit to then have to deal with all the stuff, but no equity, no ownership, no growth, no cash flow. I can't think of a worse fate.
Right. Okay. Well, there's that, folks. Tom Cruise's view on third parties.
Sorry if anyone owns a property management company for third parties, but I honestly think it's got to be the worst model because you have to have thousands of units to scale to actually make money. And when you're dealing with thousands of tenants,
then you have thousands of customers.
You have thousands of customers, and then you have thousands of people that you have to service, and you have to have a crew to support that. And
it's not where you want to go. Hey, and you know, that's the beauty of this business is you can design it the way you want, right? I mean, no one said you have to be a third-party property manager for somebody else. Tell me about how you bring and compensate, because at some point in the scaling of your company, it made sense economically to bring in a third party and say, or not a third party, but an employee. Let's say that you're now your property manager. How do you tie them to compensation on performance, or how do you set it up such that they actually care?
I overpay them. That's one thing. And it makes it very difficult to go anywhere else because they know that they're going to take a pay cut. That's one. And because I can afford to, because I'm making so much cash flow per unit. I knew when to, because I knew that I was spending way too much time talking to tenants versus acquiring properties. That came at around 30, 35 units. At that point, I honestly should have done it at 10 or 15 units. Realistically, that's my biggest regret. If I had gone back, I wasted probably a year of my life dealing with property management issues that I could have had 1,000 units by now, realistically. But yeah, everyone that I hire is entry level out of college, 60 grand, between 55 and 60 grand. In my zip code, 60 grand is a lot.
Especially just out of college.
Yeah, out of college. So at that point, there's a lot of room for growth. They can eventually be an acquisitions manager. They can eventually become, they want to help either manage the property management team, or if they want to get into a trade, I'll pay for them to go learn how to do a trade. It doesn't matter. But at that point, it just builds confidence. It builds trust. They aren't constantly looking for the next best thing. And they live at the beach and they make 60 grand. And then I can train them the way that I want to train them. You're not getting some 30-year-old professional property manager that's like, well, you know, my other company, we did it this way. Like, I don't care. It's like, we're doing it this way. On day six, we're evicting. It's not day 15 or day 20 like you might like to do. So it's just different. And I just like that control.
Right. Yeah, I know that makes a heck of a lot of sense. I like that. So bringing on people that don't have a history in the business that you can train your way.
Exactly. And it just makes a whole lot easier to manage.
Right. That's really cool. And then when you say you want to move them into the next phase, you're putting them into acquisitions or into a role that then garners a higher pay.
Yeah, it's just whatever they want to do. Because if there's acquisitions, then it's bonus based on the units and we work out different equity numbers. I mean, I've partnered with my property managers on other deals before if they want to start owning property and building their own net worth. it's really whatever they want to do. But then it keeps them happy. And if they're happy, then they're motivated and they'll pick up the phone at 10 o'clock at night. You don't get that from a $38,000 a year, no upward mobility employee.
Tell me about acquisitions on that side of things. I mean, one of the challenges that we always face in this business is that we want to see it ourselves. So how have you trained your acquisition people to be able to go out, find a property that makes sense to acquire without you having to go see it?
That part's pretty straightforward. It's all inbound. I don't have my guys going out anywhere to do that. So it's essentially what they're handling. And I don't have it right now, a fully dedicated acquisitions person. All four of my property managers do acquisitions because, I mean, they're not all like constantly busy with property management stuff all day long. And from that point on, it's just a matter of inbound leads. So I have like the We Buy House assigned. We do Facebook ads, spending probably $2,000 to $3,000 a month on simple inbound leads for We Buy ads or We Buy House ads. And then they'll field those calls. And if there's interest, they'll go out and look at the property when they're doing their rounds on property management or inspections. So just kind of like a hybrid role at this point. But what I'm saying is, like, if we get to the point where I need that full-time person, either of them can kind of step into that relatively easy. And then I have a criteria. I just have a Google Doc, very simple, 3 beds, 4 beds, the square footage, this part of town, this is what I'm looking for. And then they're just like constant hunt. And then I give them a bonus if we end up closing on that deal.
Right. Oh, that's super cool. I love that. I love the simplicity of that. It keeps things clean and measurable. Walk us through this 100 units you're about to buy. Have you commonly bought in packages or is this?
Yeah, this would be my third relatively big package. I bought another 92 units in 2019 for $6.2 million here in Wilmington. And then I stabilized that with a partner. And then 2 years later, we sold it for $10.2 million. It's all from increased rents rolls. We forced appreciation like crazy. They were all way under market rent. We did some minor renovations and then we just slammed section and tenants in all 92 of them. And then we sold it. And now these are similar situation. These are in much better shape. He wanted $10 million, about $100,000 a door in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And we worked them down quite a bit from that. So we're hopefully going to be closing next week.
That's awesome. Good for you. And your plan is wash, rinse, repeat.
Yeah, that's really it. This one I'm doing by myself. There's no partners on this deal just because I had the cash flow to sustain it. A few years ago, I didn't have $1.2 million sitting in cash waiting for it. It was all tied into real estate. So now all these deals I'm able to self-fund. So it just makes it a lot easier, a lot cleaner. And if I want a 1031 to the next one, I can do that as well. If you ever tried doing that with a partner, it's very complicated, huge pain in the ass.
It is very complicated. Yeah, walk us through that deal. I mean, how are you handling inspections? How are you handling appraisals? I mean, because that's a heck of a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, I'm working with a local bank that I have a really strong relationship with. So all this becomes super easy. I mean, 100 unit appraisal, they're not requiring full blown individual residential appraisals. We're doing a desktop appraisal from some guy's desk in Myrtle Beach. So from that point on, I think I paid literally $9,000 for all 100 appraisals. And then I hired 3 inspectors in Jacksonville and I just gave them each 30, 32 units. And just had them all go into individual reports. They all gave me $300 per. I kind of negotiated that with them because I was giving them so many deals. So then they all went out and just did that and made the reports. And then I kind of picked out which ones had the most issues. And I just used that as leverage to be able to negotiate further down.
Right. No, that makes sense. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. Man, that's cool. One of the things that you've mentioned a couple times is the banks you have good relationships with. That's a key in this business. So tell us how you have built those, why they're important, and one of the ways maybe that you have fostered such excellent relationships.
Good question. So it was just completely by accident as well and necessity. So when I started buying units, I had to essentially wherever they would lend to me, I would go there. So credit union, they would give me 3 units, right? Hey, look, we're okay exposing ourselves to 3 houses worth of risk. That's great, but I want 20 units this year. So I need to go talk to 5 other banks, right? So I go to bank 2 and I said, hey, look, I already have these units. I already have cash flow. Here are my tax returns. Like, all right, well, you're fucking 26 years old and the assets are limited. So we'll give you 5 units that you can be able to kind of grow into. And I just kind of did this rinse and repeat this 5 or 6 times to the point where I had now 6 banks lending to me their max exposure. And then every 6 months, they would give me more kind of lending power, right? So what happened was I got to a point where I had to be 100 units by myself and I was sick of dealing with all these banks. So I would say, hey, I actually sent out an email to all 6 of them. It was kind of a dick move. And I said, look, and I CC'd all of them. So they all saw each other on it. And I was like, I'm interested in consolidating all these into one loan. Whoever sends me the best term sheet by Friday, I'm just going to package all these deals and move it all into one loan, one mortgage, one payment, one headache. And they were all starting competing for the best term sheet. So they were just sending them to me. I picked the best one. I chose that. And that's the one I have a deposit relationship with. I have a credit relationship. They actually did the mortgage on this house. And then from that point on, it makes it a whole lot easier.
What's the plan when disposition comes to a large package loan like that and say you want to sell off 10 or 20 of them? Is that a challenge?
It does become somewhat of a pain in the ass. I've negotiated that before on this one, especially. It's called the release fee for people that don't know, because essentially I'm doing 85% loan to value. So I'm putting 15% down on this deal. So the way that it works is if I were to peel off individual units in the future, I need to keep that loan at an 85% loan to value. So if I, for example, sell 10 units at $2 million, $200,000 a door each, they're going to want a certain percentage of that sale in order to reduce the loan to keep everything within regulation because they get audited as well. So to answer your question, yes, I normally do 80% of the appraised value, which is also very important for getting all these individual appraisals before you close on the deal. Because then you have a basis, then they know like, oh, this house is worth this amount. So for example, if the house is worth $100,000 and you're negotiating and that's the appraised value is $100,000. And then in 2 years, I want to sell that house for $200,000. It's great because I can. The bank is going to say, hey, it appraised 2 years ago for $100,000. We're going to take 80% of that, which is $80,000. And then you can keep the other $120,000. So that's how I find it to normally works the best.
Right. Man, that's brilliant. Very good. I love how you did that. I'm sorry you weren't happy with the move, sending them all and saying, hey, guys, give me the best term sheet.
After I did it, I kind of regretted it because I had built really good relationships with them. I kind of made it like this piranha feeding frenzy. And it was actually kind of like sex. Someone was like, was my best term sheet. And it's never happened to me because I've always been the one begging for money from these banks. And now it's the other way around. It's a very funny dynamic. So I was like, this has got to be a power move that I got to pull on these guys just one good time, just so they know that. Because at that time, I mean, it was like a $4 million loan into the small community bank. That's a good size chunk of interest coming in every month.
It's a good size chunk of interest and it's a good size of their portfolio. And if it's, I mean, in loans or banks' assets.
And you couldn't get a lower risk borrower than me. I mean, at the time, it was like a 790 credit score. And these are all Section 8 tenants. They knew it was low income tenants. So they also got those affordable housing credits. So it was pretty much like a perfect deal.
Yeah, that's one of the few times maybe in life that you'll be able to say, hey, come chase me, because the rest of the world is going, dang, man, how do we get more money? So that's fun. Good for you. The little guy once in a while gets the opportunity to do that. That's a real good time. Walk us through what you see in the future. Like, where do you want to take this business and why?
Yeah, I want to get to about 1,000 units. I've kind of already had some interest from institutional investors, hedge funds, REITs that would want to buy me out. And I find that most of them are really want to start talking at about 1,000 doors. And that's something I would do. I don't want to be in this forever. I think that I would probably keep maybe a portion just for tax purposes, but with the right number between 800 and 1,000 units, I would just sell out and then do the next thing. Which is a nice thing for me would be venture capitalist. I really like getting into startups. That's what I was doing before. I had like tech startup. I did marketing, that and education. I mean, I'm actually on live right now on TikTok Live. I enjoy talking about real estate and kind of helping other people with it. So that combined with venture capitalist or angel investing, all three would probably be the next step.
Gotcha. Hey, that's cool. I love hearing what people's dreams and plans are as they move forward. I know you mentioned maybe one thing earlier about a mistake that you had made. Typically a question I ask on this show, if there's anything that you could do differently, what would it be and why?
Yeah, I would have started networking a lot more aggressively a lot sooner. Combine that with the managing less properties, that's not really that big of a deal. I would have started making more high net worth individual connections out of college or even sooner, as soon as I could, because I would have been able to grow a lot faster. Because I mean, the first couple dozen units, I had to self-fund. I mean, I had a wholesale, I had to reinvest, I had to cash out refinance, I need to reinvest cash from marketing. I mean, pretty much every month was a struggle to find enough cash to fund my cash required to close. I had months where I put a property under contract and I didn't even have the cash required to close. I just did it because it forced me to figure out a way to do it. And I was like, oh shit, well, I guess worst case scenario on the closing day, I'll tell them, sorry, I can't buy it. I literally can't afford it. But fortunately, that never happened. But I had situations where I would do cash advances on my credit card, go grab the cash, get a certified check, go and close on it because I didn't care. All I cared about was acquiring the unit. I wanted one unit per month. And then I got two units per month, three units per month. And then at my height in 2017, 2018, I was doing almost 40 units per month. And that just came through just grinding.
Right. Man, that's great. When you look back, what are some things that you feel like you've really done well or right that others should emulate?
I would say just to get started. I mean, it's very generic and I hate saying cliche shit, but that's where most people get stuck. and I coach people every day. So I see this every day. It's like, I have people out here with three monitors doing pro forma and cash flow analysis and ROI and internal rate of return and cap rate and cash on cash return on a $60,000 single unit. It's like, dude, go buy the house, figure this shit out as you go. So that's the biggest thing, is most people get stuck in this analysis paralysis and they never end up buying a unit. And I tell everybody, it's like a drug. After your first unit and after you get that first check and that first cash flow, you're like, I have to continue doing this any means necessary. So just get started is the number one piece of advice. And then from that point on, everything will fall into place. Talk about what you do is another big thing. I would always talk about my deals on Section 8 or kind of my journey on Instagram stories. And then people start knowing that I do that. And then what happens? People start sending me deals. Now I probably get 50 deals a day from Instagram, TikTok, email, just people like, oh yeah, I saw you do Section 8. My mom's selling her house in Missouri. Do you want it? I was like, there's equity. Yeah, sure. So yeah, that all comes into it.
Right. Man, that's great. That's great. Tom, thanks so much for your time today. Let's jump here into a few questions to wrap this up. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
One big mistake to avoid is don't force the deal. If the deal is going to happen, make sure that it's going to cash flow. Make sure that you're not going to have a bunch of problems with it afterwards. As much as I say, get started, make sure that you're not doing it just to do it. I've done that where I've just wanted to buy units that month. And then those were the worst units that I bought. I didn't do enough due diligence, or I didn't get a good enough financial terms. I should have waited longer. I would say, make sure you do your due diligence and then go and buy the property and then cash flow from it. And then just rinse and repeat that as many times as you want.
Right. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Oh man, I give away a lot of money either through TikTok. I do a lot of giveaways. I do this thing called F Evictions Friday, where every Friday I try to help at least 5 people get out of an eviction, because I know how much it sucks being on that side of evicting people. So I try to help people with evictions all the time. I give away to just local shelters. I'm actually going to do an endowment at my local university. I'm trying to get my name on a building. But yeah, I mean, just mostly local stuff, and then just helping where I can online and just answering questions and helping with financial literacy.
That's awesome, Tom. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I answer most of my DMs on Instagram, which is TCruzNC. That's TCRUZNC. And then also on TikTok, I have most of my video contents there. Same handle, TCruzNC. And then also, if they're interested in learning about the Section 8 course, it's section8formula.com, like a mini webinar that explains how to get started with Section 8. And then you can book a call with me if you're interested.
Awesome. Tom, thanks so much, man. It's been great. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.